You are listening to Octahedron Episode 3, a podcast about protocols and systems without centralized ownership. It is Tuesday, the 29th of November 2016, and we are coming to you from a secret location in Berlin, the SDev office. And it's really cool to actually do a podcast directly from here. And today with us, we have a guest, Victor Tron. Say something.
Hi.
And my co-host, Dirk Jekyll.
I am also here. Dirk Jekyll.
So we're going to be talking about Ethereum latest news and also Swarm and other things. So
yeah, maybe we should introduce our guest or
yes,
have him.
Or you can introduce yourself, please.
What's your relationship to Ethereum?
So I work for the foundation. I've been working on Ethereum since the basically very beginning, and since the first crowd sale, I'm an employee or like contractor for the foundation. I was one of the first people hired by Jeff to be part of the Go team, and since then I've been working on the Go client. I've been doing like lots of different areas in the Go development. Nowadays, in the past year or so at least, I've been working on Swarm. Swarm is a decentralized storage and content distribution network, and basically a cloud service also of the Ethereum ecosystem, or aspires to be.
Yeah, I always
in the making.
Yeah, I always confuse it with Whisper. So it's the storage, the external storage system.
Yes, we sometimes call it the holy trinity of the Ethereum ecosystem. It's like the Ethereum as the blockchain, Swarm for storage, and Whisper for communications.
Yeah. Okay, so last week on Friday, you stayed here longer than usual. Would you like to elaborate why you had to stay longer at the office?
I don't remember what you mean. Oh, sorry.
You told me you would be fixing Geth.
I don't know if it was Friday.
Ah, okay. Yeah, it was. I think it was.
Yeah. So before we jump into Swarm, you promised to tell us what happened recently when Parity and Geth decided not to be friends anymore.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I see. So that was the day of the fork. I think it was on Wednesday. It's pretty much the most horrible thing that can happen to a blockchain project, which is basically an unintentional fork. What's an unintentional fork is, it's a fork because one part, usually like it's interesting if it's like a substantial part of the network, is is thinking the head of the chain, head of the blockchain, is different than from the other half, or let's say half and half.
Like
what can the reason be for this? I mean, the reason for this can be that they think of the validity of blocks in a different way, which means basically a consensus failure. It can happen if the VM operations are not identically programmed to operate. They are allowed to operate in somewhat different ways.
So if the outcome is different from the same operation.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Correct. Now obviously this is like, you know, we have 100 million tests about the operation of VM. So as you probably would expect, this only appears in very, very strange and rare edge cases. And this is exactly what happened. So the specification that the implementers followed was not entirely specific about that particular detail, although it has to be said that during the implementation, the coders actually agreed on the outcome for this particular edge case. However, there was still
room for assumptions.
Yeah, so there was still a problem implementing that correctly, and as it turns out, both Parity and Geth had had a missed edge case where they behaved not according to what they agreed on. But the main point was that, you know, Geth had a bug, and so as a result, Parity and Geth thought of the chain as differently. And we were in till late, because I was on the hotline of like the core developers who were working on the fix. I mean, here credits are due, obviously. I didn't really contribute to this fix at all.
So. Ah, okay. But you had to do the release?
No. It's just, I really was just, you know, following the discussion, you know, try to help as much as I could.
Yeah, okay.
Just to be clear that I wasn't responsible for fixing it, and the other guys did a really great job. Like they found the problem quite quickly.
So what about other clients? I mean, apart from Parity, and I know that other clients are rather rare, like Java implementation and C++ implementation.
Yes. Yes.
But were they also, did they decide to agree with Geth or Parity, and how did they behave? Do you know anything?
Well, as much as I know, I don't think that the C++ client has implemented these fixes. So it's pretty much considered probably unmaintained, but I'm not taking full responsibility for this statement, so I have to look whether there's been any fix. I don't think so. And as for the Java client, I also don't know. But
yeah, maybe you should use. Could you move your microphone and away, like a bit down? Okay. Yeah, should be better now.
So, but at least as a result of such consensus failures and fixes, the specifications become really, really solid, and that's probably a very welcome outcome. It's a bit like when you sprain your ankle, like you will never sprain it exactly the same place, because the muscles just became much stronger. It's kind of unfortunate situation, but the outcome is actually quite welcome in a way.
So should we just move on to like a slightly different topic? You went to the DEF CON as well, the last DEF CON.
Yes.
And we didn't really cover that, but what your impression of what your impressions? I haven't been to. It's the first DEF CON I haven't been to. I have to brag about the fact that I actually been to two of them.
Yes.
So what happened, and what your what did you bring?
It was really fantastic to see all these interested people, and like in such big numbers. So there was a crowd of like nearly 800 people that actually, you know, paid their ticket and made their way all the way to China, and the quality of the presentations were amazing, and then the width. What I also found very interesting is that, first of all, you see all the step up, like since DEF CON 1, which was in the city of London, also quite prestigious. But since then, everything changed. Like the audiovisual equipment was like amazing, and like, you know, a camera on a crane with various angles.
So that was
unfortunately, the DEF CON presentations that are up on YouTube are not doing justice. And actually,
so you had this camera in Shanghai or in London?
In Shanghai.
In Shanghai.
And also like in general, like the it was in the Hyatt, and there was really, really interesting to see all these big players being interested in the field. Truth be told, I also met a few people who, like, you know, were clearly just following the hype of blockchain. When asked, they would just say like, okay, we need to do something blockchain, and they had probably no idea what they were actually doing. It has to be said. The other thing is that I did actually talk to a few industry people, and to my great surprise, there's quite a bit of interest in Swarm and some of these decentralized technologies from companies that are not typically, you know, interested in the kind of grassroots things like decentralization.
Do you have an example? I mean, you don't have to name any company.
I mean,
but
just
like the industry, which
for example, like I had a really enlightening talk with a gentleman from the aerospace industry, who talked to me about their use case of being in a consortium of like maybe a few hundred members, they manufacture parts of with that needs extreme precision, an awful lot of very very intricate 3D designs, which immense amounts of data, and this data is moving on a daily basis. Now they have consortium members who like the suppliers of like a little screw in the system. The others ship the actual data models and like push terabytes every day. And I, at first I was very skeptical. I thought, this guy, they probably need just, an Oracle database or something like this. Yeah. And, I was kind of a little bit, I would admit, even dismissive, like deep inside. But I was totally convinced by the use case that these companies don't really cater for the needs of this consortium situations, because what they really want is corporations that are sitting on a lot of money to lock them in for longer maintenance of a software, and therefore they're not really interested in having deals where like there's some sort of proportional sharing of resources between consortium members. So here the idea would be that some of these suppliers could contribute their entire cloud infrastructure, their data centers, and small players can also contribute their share, and with the decentralized storage and distribution, a lot of the integrity protection and the efficient real-time download can be solved. And most importantly, they could have a very thorough and extremely detailed accounting system between each other. They can use the blockchain and the swap system that we have in Swarm.
What is the swap system?
Swap system stands for like Swarm accounting protocol. It's basically a peer-to-peer pairwise accounting system. So what it does is basically when I'm connecting with you on a communication channel, I basically count the number of, let's say, packets or bytes
that you
send me. And the other way around. Mm-hmm. And we keep a tally, and in a proper trustless decentralized situation, this can serve as, you can basically credit your peer with a certain amount, but if you don't trust them, then your tolerance is quite low. So if they don't pay you after accumulating a certain tilt or like difference in balance, so basically they accrue debt. And if they don't send you a check after a particular amount is reached, then you may just disconnect and never trust them again. Mm-hmm. Now, in a consortium situation, obviously this swap could just be used as an accounting system.
I have a question, because since you mentioned consortia, and most of the time what we see in industrial applications, they prefer to use a consortium chain, or at least try to build a prototype which is not a big public chain like Ethereum.
Yeah.
So is Swarm also compatible, theoretically can be used in the consortium chain?
Yeah, I mean, let's be more technical about this. So Swarm itself is not dependent so much on the blockchain, on its own own operation.
Even not for swap.
It is for swap.
Okay.
For swap business, yeah. Okay. So it only needs the blockchain for say a domain name lookup and some sort of authentication if you have, okay. And on the one hand and the incentive system like the actual payments on the other, but. And here, of course, the blockchain could be used as the ultimate judge of the fairness of how they share resources, and that's already a pretty big gain for companies like this. I mean, I learned that what they basically do is like they do rsync type pushes of terabytes of data every morning, and often there. Their data push fails and they don't know where to restart. I mean,
so this accounting could also help in proving that something was reliably received and where to continue.
In fact, you don't need swap for that. Like Swarm already,
that
take care of that. Okay. Kind of. both the integrity protection via hashes. And
is it really a problem for them that, I mean, I could imagine that it's a problem if it takes too long to send data from A to B, but do they really have to pay for transferring the data? I mean, they should all have, like,
The point is that it's very difficult to have an agreement with a completely different company about basically sharing your infrastructure. There's all kinds of problems with the authentication, with who contributes what, who pays for the for certain aspects of the service.
Okay, and this is a problem because there are so many players in this consortium and they don't have, I mean, they all have bilateral contracts and not, I mean, I would think that this should be easier than it needs a blockchain to solve this. But
you're absolutely right. I can also imagine like a simpler system. However,
Swarm
is less like, provides a lot of the functionality.
So they knew what they were talking about. They looked at it and they're still interested.
That was my impression from the DEFCON. So that was very interesting to see like all these kind of new type of faces, people from Cisco and like, you know, big companies like this. I'm used to the, you know,
to the
grassroots unconference scene of, you know.
Should we then just, as we mentioned Swap, should we just go through the Swarm and how it works?
Okay.
Where the data is stored and so on.
Okay.
So is there a Swarm implementation already that I can run on my notebook?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
There is the it's alpha software.
Yeah.
It's at the proof of concept state, 0.2.
Is it part of Geth?
And since the 1.5 release, which happened like a few weeks ago, and where since when there was a lot of mishaps.
Yeah.
Hopefully this situation stabilized now. So as part of that Geth release, Swarm was included as an experimental feature. It's actually recommended to be run as a separate daemon, which means that it's as a process, it's also separate from the Geth instance. This is mainly to protect people from, you know, starting it like in production with the swap option open and like on their main chain with their wallets. I mean, just we want to be really secure and make sure that even if there's some blatant problem with the swap system, then, you know, people not gonna just lose their money on the main chain.
So this thing has its own wallet?
So no, but you connect an account to it when you use the swap. Now the swap system is currently switched off on the by default, but you can always try it out. The test net is basically being swapped out now to a new one which runs the daemons, and we'll basically reset its own chain and connect to the Ropsten testnet, which we just launched.
That's the switch from Morden to Ropsten.
Right? It wasn't Morden, it was its own private chain previously.
For Swarm it was not Morden. Okay. But Ropsten now supports Swarm.
Yes. Ropsten
now supports Swarm? Or does it even need to?
A blockchain doesn't need to support, more than blockchain supports any dApp, you know.
Okay.
The swap has a contract which is deployed on the chain if you switch it on. The other use case that I mentioned is domain name resolution, so basically the DNS, which is called ENS Ethereum Name System. It's Nick Johnson's fantastic work. And that's also a contract on the Ropsten blockchain. It's already deployed. You can interact with this name service via like a really, really cool JavaScript interface.
So not Ropsten itself supports Swarm, but there is now example contracts that make it possible to use the current deployment of Swarm clients to use it there.
Correct. I mean, this is being done as we speak. So it's really, really hot, fresh and hot from the engine.
Is there any need or support, or does it make sense? So I'm more interested in the Light protocol. Is there any relation to the Light protocol, or will there be Light clients supporting, maybe not offering Swarm services, yes, but consuming Swarm services? Or is
yes. So I'm not sure exactly what you meant, but so the Light client protocol, which is the LES protocol, is completely independent of Swarm. It's like nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
However, Light client functionality has always been in the plan for Swarm. It's just okay, you know, we don't have enough hands right now.
Yeah.
And so that would work by basically, you know, storing the blockchain and the most importantly the state and contract storage data on Swarm, and in similarly to the Light client functionality, any queries that require the blockchain would be retrieved on demand, and then in the case of Swarm, it's done through the Swarm retrieval. In case of the Light client protocol, it's done via its own similar protocol to the ETH protocol.
So the idea, just so I understand, because I haven't looked too much into it. So the idea is a client would connect to a Light client, for example, would connect to the Ethereum blockchain and pay to be able to retrieve certain files, and would basically pay for the right to retrieve those files from Swarm nodes somewhere. Then it would retrieve those files once, and then it would be settled. The deal would be done. So I pay for it, I get the file, I'm done. Was that something that would be possible?
Yes, it's something like that. Let's dive in more deeply, what you actually pay for, because there's obviously the infrastructure cost. That's what Swarm is primarily concerned with.
It's not about IP.
Exactly. So it's nothing to do with what content.
Mm-hmm.
If we talk about content, that's another topic we can talk about as well.
So,
but first of all, what I told you about these incentive structures and the swap payment, it's basically tracking data in kilobytes. So any kind of data is exactly the same from the point of view.
Okay, so it's net neutrality based in Ethereum or in Swarm.
And that's the case. In fact, even with the Light client that I'm glad you mentioned, that is probably also only really complete that project if that includes or implements some sort of incentivization, because after all, for the Light clients to work, you need to have full nodes who so-called Light servers who are actually willing to serve these Light clients. Yeah. And if there's not enough of them, you know, then there may be some Light clients will, you know, be willing to pay some price for their quick connection. In which case, like, you know, that would incentivize the Light servers to switch on their servers, etc. So it's basically the same idea. You can use the swap protocol on top of that.
Uh-huh. I never thought of it this way. So in the ecosystem of Light clients and full nodes, that's what it can be used for.
Yes.
And so
at the moment it's not implemented this incentivization. So at the moment it's kind of, you know, more like a voluntary service if people run Light servers. You can already see actually that there's not a lot of them. So often Light clients, if people are, you know, testing it out now, because that's also just freshly included in the Geth release, so it's quite popular and people try it out, and they experiencing some difficulty finding nodes to connect to. So
Do I understand it correctly? So you said that the content the content part is not so as important. Is somehow I went mono.
Yeah, sorry. Please continue.
No, so but what's important is that you can see that this data went from this part to this part, and it has gone there. So not to prove that I took your content, but whether, like you mentioned in the industrial application, where I have to I have to push terabytes of data somewhere, and then it stops, and I don't know where it stops. So with Swarm, I can.
Oh yeah, yeah. So this itself is not like really a big problem. I mean, the people have solved it with many kind of, you know, authentication solutions to track, you know, what the integrity of partial files and stuff like that. So, but what with the consortium I mentioned before, it was just interesting to see like how Swarm as a comprehensive solution like served almost all their needs. It's not a big claim of like in technical innovation there. Although in a truly decentralized setting, I have to say that, you know, Swarm has some claim to having innovative features. Most of all, the possibility. I hope you don't mind that I go into this now.
No,
so,
it's fine.
Yeah,
so the possibility that you can, it's not only a decentralized storage system like what BitTorrent is, or you know what, you know, currently IPFS provides, but also an outright cloud service in the sense that you can push data to it. There is a genuine sense in which you can post data to the Swarm. That's somewhat an unknown and unexplored area in the decentralized storage and content distribution space, and this has very interesting consequences of, you know, how we store data and then, you know, how the Swarm is supposed to work. Sorry, going back to the original question. Yes, yeah, so when I said the content is not important, I just meant very specifically that with the swap accounting and the actual Swarm incentives themselves, we don't really care about what you download in the, like, we don't count for the value of, you know, of a Madonna song that you listen to, like, with the decentralized Spotify that we're gonna have, but so that's a different layer that handles that. So it's not part of the Swarm incentives. The Swarm incentives is really about just, you know, pushing data around and the infrastructural costs of that, notably bandwidth and disk space. And we have to have like very carefully designed systems to handle those incentives that, you know, so that will motivate people to contribute their hard disk and contribute their bandwidth.
Is there a way to have different pricing for the content of the data, or is it not possible to have different prices?
Okay. So this sounds a bit like the question of like, do you beat your wife in the morning or in the evening? So the question presupposes that it was actually possible to set prices for content. It's not immediately obvious that is so. Think of the whole DRM debate currently. Yeah. It's actually not clear to me how to do this properly. And it's even less clear to me how.
No, I'm totally fine if it's not possible. I mean,
there's interesting possibilities with blockchains, actually, but.
But it's not implemented in a way that it is possible to have a different price for different data, except when it comes faster or more at a time. It's only about the distribution of the data, not of the content.
Yes, but to answer your question, it is possible to charge for content because it's very easy to implement. I mean, just imagine like a link in a dApp that notifies you that it will trigger a smart contract, which if you pay into, you get a token, and that token will decrypt. So you can even have like some sort of DRM protection.
Yeah. Okay. The problem is that
I'm talking about. I mean, we don't have to go into this because it's a bit of a Pandora's box. But the point is, what I was trying to make is that even though it's possible to write such a thing, the fundamental problem remains that. Once you have the data, copying that data is costless, and you can redistribute it. Piracy cannot be circumvented.
So socially, it kind of doesn't make sense because you can play it.
Yes, in a way. Although we already see like interesting studies in at least in the Western world that people are actually willing to contribute their money to content producers, and they're more motivated to do so as long as they know that the funds are not disappearing in the drawers of a collection society, of a record label, or some sort of other evil intermediary who just, you know, use their in the past accrued powers and then like centralized position to keep the barriers of entry high. So once we have a system, and this is where we really can talk about the power of blockchain. When we have systems like that where the default interaction is directly peer to peer in a trustless setting, then this is very fundamental, because this, in the idea world at least, this kind of forces onto intermediaries that they should have value added to that transaction. So since the default is the direct interaction between, say, fans who want to contribute to content producers, all kind of intermediaries are they have to be
useful.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Interesting take on the topic. So sorry, Xenia, you are mono and I can't do anything about it.
I just remain mono and I'm going to annoy all the listeners with it. Sorry, can you just put your mic a little bit further and down again? I think that's better like this. So I had a question sort of similar to Dirk's question about how ready it is. And you said that it's like beta, experimental, but people can already play with it. So my question is, if let's say people want to hack something together and they need maybe some more sophisticated system, then they need more sophisticated incentive system, or can they already, is there enough documentation and enough stuff that people can, let's say, use it in a hackathon or use it in a prototype to show, let's say, their client to say, yeah, that's how we do it, and that's going to be ready in some future to industrial scale.
So no. Yes and no. So the basic operation of like, you know, upload, download, retrieval, you know, streaming a video and stuff like that is working, okay? If you want to demo the incentive system itself, that's not ready, except for the swap. The swap does work, actually, if you switch it on, but, you know, just be careful with it and don't use your real chain wallet, but the storage incentives, which is really the interesting and most innovative part in our plans, that's not implemented yet, and we're working on this.
Are there any nodes? I mean, okay, now with the Robson test network, probably every node can run this swarm daemon separately and just say, it's okay if you use 10 gigabyte of my local storage and if you use 50% of my upstream and 50% of my downstream. Is it that way?
Correct. Absolutely correct. It's exactly that way. I mean, of course, since it's an experimental feature and a specific different process, which is not switched on by default, you know, people who run Robston blockchain client, They have to specifically want to run a swarm as well to be part of it, but yet it's possible. And then we expect a lot of people to join and you know, help us in the testing. There's going to be ample documentation. We're just working on it now.
It sounds interesting, because actually I have a host at home that could do exactly that. I mean, yeah, okay, interesting. And there would be also a Robston Ether to gain, to see. So I would have a Robston wallet, and I would see the Ether coming in if somebody puts file on my server gets them from there.
Yeah, as I said, the swap is not really switched on. So, if you switch on or when we reach that, I kind of think that it's gonna come in POC 04, when we have both incentives to try out.
So the POCs count now from Robston again?
No, just we are at POC 0.2.
For Swarm.
For Swarm.
Ah, okay. Sorry. Because we were at 9 for Ethereum already.
Sorry. I mean, so POC Ethereum is production.
Yeah. You know, okay. There is no POC
that had
anymore.
That had POC before we launched the frontier.
Okay, so we are at POC 2 for
Swarm.
For Swarm.
Yes, and I think that when the incentives will come and be switched on, that's going to be the one after the next, so the fourth iteration.
And what comes with the next iteration? Let us have a peek.
Next iteration is completely rewriting the network layer.
Okay.
Because it had some design faults, and anyway, everything is so much better when you do it the second time.
Yeah.
And it brings a lot more stability, a lot more certainty that your chunk request is not timing out, because there's going to be a little bit more sophisticated routing, and also a lot more efficient bandwidth wise, because the peer communication is much less heavy.
Okay, so this layer, but this layer is Swarm specific. It's not dev P2P. It's
Well, it's kind of dev P2P. The Swarm protocol is based on dev P2P, so it's a dev P2P protocol. The efficiencies are not, you know, it's not a reworking of the dev P2P part, but reworking of you know how the requests are handled, how the syncing process works, how the routing is done, etc.
By the way, how do you, if I mentioned it that I would like to set limits, like for bandwidth, how would you even measure that you are not above my limit?
So we don't have measurements for bandwidth at the moment.
Yeah,
and any more than just, you know, counting the bytes. So
counting the bytes per time that come in or go out and are acknowledged or
yes, and as for
I mean, that should be good enough, probably.
Yes. as for the storage that you dedicate, you say like that you want a particular amount of gigabytes, say.
Yeah,
that the storage respects this, and basically garbage collects or deletes stuff if you would go up above that limit.
Yeah, how?
And that's exactly the problem.
Yeah,
because
what would you delete? I mean, you can't take in more.
Very,
right?
Very, very good question. So, so this is exactly the interesting part of Swarm, because on the one hand, it's a full utilization scheme, because the idea is
what does
that
it mean?
Full utilization means that if you dedicate a particular amount of storage, then the node is caching all the traffic that goes through it, because the incentive system incentivizes it to cache content because it might be requested from it next time, and if they have it, then
there is
they will be
to
the
keep
one
it.
To
yeah.
keep it. Yeah. Yes, but now if there's an incentive to keep stuff, then of course after a while you reach your limit and you need to delete something. So what to delete? As it turns out, the simplest heuristics that maximizes your profit is to delete the stuff that was requested the longest time ago.
Yeah.
So like the last request.
Yeah, you keep the stuff that was recently requested.
Yes. And of course, that's a problem, because that means that unpopular content
will
not persist.
Yeah.
And that's why we need storage insurance or some sort of storage incentive system, which, you know, tries to address this problem, that if you upload your birth certificate, which you access every 10 years, if at all,
yeah,
but you really want to have it when you want to access it,
yeah,
then you can make sure that this is the case.
So,
and that's a very interesting part of the system. Yeah,
I would tag it as this is important to me. No, that's not how it works. Or can I?
Well, if it was only you storing it,
then
you just tag it that it's important. Then you don't delete it because it's yours.
Yeah,
but
I don't.
The problem with Swarm is that you store other people's stuff.
Yeah,
and
other people store my stuff.
Other people tag it, but what do I care if they tag it? I just delete it anyway.
So there's no way to, I mean, what you could do, it's just speculating, but there might, you might be able to know if this stuff is stored elsewhere.
Yeah, so,
and,
so the idea
if it's,
that
it's if it's stored elsewhere or in enough places, like above a threshold, then you can delete it. But if it's below the threshold, then my host should keep it. Or if it has this insurance flag,
That's correct. So this is exactly how it works. So we have a tentative solution to this, quite well worked out, which we published in the Orange Paper series. That's a system called Swear and Swindle. So it's altogether it's Swap, Swear and Swindle as kind of playful name for this scheme. So Swear and Swindle is basically based on the idea that you, in order to give a receipt, give out a promise that you store something, which is what ultimately allows you to be paid, because
someone comes and gets it.
Yes. So I will explain shortly. So to give out a receipt, you need to register and put something on the line so that you have some stake to lose if you misbehave.
Yeah, okay.
So misbehaving here means that you promise to store that particular content and you
and then you don't have
actually,
it.
You still delete it. Now, the interesting part in this, like, this sounds like, you know, normal insurance, you know, you promise to store it, we have a contract, we just agree.
However, can I just check if you stored it?
That's a very good question, very good question. So that's exactly how it works, because, you know, if I give you the birth certificate for 10 years, I mean, you know, the little devil in me will say, oh,
I have to check
really
if it's still
it.
There.
So what do I do? Download it? But then the whole point is kind of missed. If you constantly need to download and need to check it, then it's first it's expensive. It's totally superfluous bandwidth because I didn't actually need that. Yeah. And on the other hand, it's also, you know.
But I could ask for a checksum for a
like
certain
this.
Byte range.
So that particular construct is called the proof of custody, a proof of storage. This is kind of a field of in cryptography that how you prove to a third party, also provable to a third party that you have a certain content without retrieving the entire
content. There is already a protocol for that.
There's various schemes for that. That's what the second Orange Paper is about, a particular swarm type scheme for this.
Okay.
A type of scheme that scales for really large document collections. So proof of custody, once again, is something like to have a proof that you have some content at a particular time, because you can't just generate the proof of custody in advance and just skip that.
It's interactive.
So it has to be some sort of interactive, So you release some sort of data at a particular time, and that data should be somehow integrated in the proof, so that, and plus the data. But anyway, so the point is in that storage insurance is that, so first of all, you can pay in installments, and the installments are released by an escrow condition, so to say.
Ah, someone else can check it for me?
Yes, exactly.
That's neat.
In fact, the blockchain checks it for you.
Okay.
So what you have is a payment channel type of solution, where the payment channel
checks that the data is still there.
Can release a particular installment of a storage insurance if it receives a valid proof of custody, and you don't have to care about anything. This automatically.
But it's not possible. But it's not possible for the storer. So the person that stores my content, it's not possible to look into that insurance and see what they would ask for. That is cryptographically impossible.
Yes, it has to be. So there has to be some, as you said about the interactivity, there has to be some sort of release of a new information which has to be included in the proof. There's I don't know of any other way to make sure that...
It sounds difficult in a public blockchain, right? to be able to have... code on the blockchain be able to check interactively that something is stored on a server without the server being able to know what they would ask for? I mean, I can imagine it's possible, but it sounds complicated.
It's not actually.
It's not. Okay. It's how not how do you do it?
So there's a there's an interesting way to do it. So if you release a particular seed at a particular time, then that seed is then hashed together with part of the data, like an arbitrary, randomly derived part of the data, which because of the Merkle structure, it basically proves that you have the entire file, and that result of the integrity of potentially a large collection of files, that that result can be checked against an outcome committed earlier to the chain. So what it would look like is that you would basically commit the hash of the result, which means that you cannot guess
without
what the result is without actually calculating it.
Yeah, without the seed and the data. Mm-hmm. So you need both. But how is the seed protected?
Oh, okay. So that's actually an interesting question. So, of course, if you're an online node yourself, you can release it with any time you want, which would probably be you would also be restricted to have to release it in order to have your contract valid. So when you want to pay an installment, you have to release a seed a particular amount of time before that. Now, you're asking, like, for example, can there be a service like so that I can completely go offline?
Yeah.
So that's what we call the upload and disappear scenario, that we really want to care for this extreme case, that you upload the swarm and immediately have a settling insurance and you can go away.
Yeah.
So for that, you can incentivize seed releasers.
Yeah.
And
okay.
So they
must not collude with the person storing.
Yes, and there's interesting ways to kind of stop that from happening.
Okay.
Most of what the other interesting part, which may help understand why this is even plausible, is because storage insurance that's what I kind of wanted to say from the beginning, that here storage insurance is somewhat different from, like in two ways, different from normal insurance. First of all, it's not compensatory in the sense that the insurance is just a disincentive, meaning that the money that's at stake is going to be burned.
Okay.
And therefore the node that foul plays will be punished.
Yeah.
However, it cannot be really compensatory because then you can basically collude with an early exit with a friend if you have another accusation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And actually, you don't need it to be. What did you say? What was the word?
Friend.
No, I meant how it doesn't need to be an insurance that pays out.
What? Compensatory.
Compensatory.
Yes.
It doesn't need to be, because if my data is gone, no compensation will help me. I will not get it back.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, but usually you do want compensation for your things sometimes. So
okay.
And plus there's no limit on the subjective value of any data.
Yeah, it could.
So let's be clear. There's gonna be a third layer of insurance, which is probably like normal third party insurance, like for as with anything.
And that
people
is compensatory.
Yes, that would be compensatory. That could be same as like. Like insuring your house, your car.
Yeah.
Now the other thing is that one thing was that it's not compensatory. The other thing is it's not actually a contract with a particular node or individual. How does that work? It works by using the special feature of Swarm that it has semi-permanent node connections first, and a kind of relaying mechanism. So when I upload something, and you are my peer, direct peer, I just give it to you. Mm-hmm. Do whatever you want with this. And they take it and they give you a receipt.
Okay.
Which means that ultimately they are responsible from now on what happens to that file. But ultimately they're not going to store it, but they forward it to the address that the notes, that those chunks should be stored at. So you have a chain of chunk and receipt swaps, yeah, which end up with the closest nodes, mm-hmm, that will ultimately store it. However, if the network grows and I find another node that's closer, then they basically have to take that chunk if they register the node. And so basically I will get the receipt from them. Now, if it all comes to litigation, what this means? Litigation means that basically the blockchain is used as a judge in the case of disputes. Here the dispute is, you lost one chunk of my birth certificate. Yeah. So I litigate on the blockchain, which means that I send in my receipt to a smart contract, and that prompts the guy who I suing to respond.
So the first
they can they the can chain. Respond two ways. One, to show the content,
or in which case, show the receipt of the next.
Correct. So there's a finger pointing, like shifting the blame to another party.
Okay, and there is redundancy, I suppose,
or it could have plus a completely separate system of redundancy using erasure coding, and erasure coding is basically a technique to how to represent data the most efficiently so that it's replicable. What is replicable? It means that if you have like 10 megabytes, mm-hmm, how you can chop it up into pieces of an inflated form of this document, say like inflated to 150 megabytes,
yeah,
and chop that up in pieces so that any combination of 2/3 of the files will restore my original content, yeah, but if it's less than that, then there's no guarantee.
Yeah, that reminds me of NetNews parity files, I think they were called. So if you had you needed 100 files, and then there were 3 parity files, yes, or something like that.
It's called parity chunk in our
yeah,
case.
Yeah, you could replace any file of the regular files with one of the parity files, correct, or something like that. So this is similar.
Correct. It's exactly the same, yes.
Ah, interesting.
It's a special scheme that we use in... The actual erasure coding is not special that we're going to use, but what's special about it is that we apply the erasure coding on each level of the chunked tree.
Okay.
So when a content is uploaded to Swarm, it's chopped into pieces, and the pieces are built up in a hierarchy, in a tree, which means that if you take the first chunk, you hash it, you take the hash of the second one, etc., up to like 128 chunks.
So you have integrity.
And then the next level that gives you the series of chunk, the series of hashes will give you another chunk. And then you take the hash of that, etc.
Okay,
it's
like
gonna be a logarithmic Merkle tree of chunk trees, of chunks.
I have a question, even though I'm mono and I try to talk as little as I can, because it's very annoying for the listeners. Well, not too annoying, because I have a nice voice. So my question is basically, when I send my data to Swarm, can whoever stores it somehow figure out what it is? Because, for instance, in Golem, which does rendering or computation, yes, this is not solved. So if I compute something, I know exactly what it is, or I can figure it out.
Okay, so this is slightly different with computation, because it's often impossible to. It's in normal cases it's impossible to calculate something on a piece of data without knowing that data.
Yeah, but
although there's a technique called homomorphic encryption, mm-hmm, which is exactly means that, like homomorphic, it means that there's a type of encryption on which you can do a calculation on the encryption. And
without
and the result will be decryptable, encrypted to the actual result in another space. Now with Swarm there's no calculations or there's no massaging of data that you need. So mm-hmm. the task is a bit simpler. And this problem in general is called, of course, you can just consider the problem of having your data private, but that's not a big deal because you can just encrypt it yourself.
And have a key.
Yeah, and have a key. However, the problem is kind of from another angle, which is like the general problem is called plausible deniability.
Mm.
It means that in systems where you cache or store other people's content, you might be concerned with what you store.
Yeah, there is illegal content.
Because in some jurisdictions, like there's no free information, so there's either copyright issues rising from availability of data on your computer, or even worse, like there's some sort of illegal content that you might not want to expose to. So the solution to this is a very interesting problem. Basically, the idea is that of course, if you want to store your content encrypted, that's not mm-hmm. I mean that's another problem. That's not.
Yeah. But I want to be able to prove that I'm unable to decrypt it. That would be nice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that is possible with a scheme called double masking. It's called double masking or triple mm-hmm. masking, because you don't only mask the data by encryption, but you also mask the key. And the way you do it, because obviously the scheme needs to be easy for, so if you know the hash or the address of a chunk, you want to be able to decrypt it without extra information. At least that would be nice, because otherwise you have to keep
the key separate
each chunk.
Yeah.
Now the solution is to encrypt the chunk with itself, with its own hash, and then store it at the address of the hash of the hash, or some sort of transformation of that hash.
So if I know the hash, then
and then the storer can throw away the original hash, and they have plausible deniability there, because there's no way they can ever know the content, because there's no way they can tell the.
I think I don't get it yet. You have the original content and you calculate a hash over it.
Yes.
And then you take.
You encrypt the chunk with the.
Then I use the hash to encrypt the original data.
Yes.
So the hash is the key.
Yes.
And then I get data.
And then you just hash the hash.
And then
you transform the hash into something with something with this deterministic. Just the easiest thing is to hash it, which is not reversible.
Yeah.
And store it at that.
How do I decrypt it?
So so when you decrypt, you actually get the request with the original hash, which everybody knew before. So if I get the original hash, I hash it, I look up the content, I decrypt it with the original hash, if I want to see it.
I still don't get it.
No. So you have the original hash. Right?
Yeah. So I have the content.
Yes.
Let's say this is the content.
Yes.
And this is the hash. And now I use this hash to encrypt this content.
You get the garbage stuff.
Yeah, I get new content.
And if you don't know this, you don't know the garbage, right? You don't know this hash. Now you don't have to know this hash, because I hash it and mask it.
Yeah,
I mask it by hashing it and throw away the original one. I store it at that address. So whenever I get a retrieval request with the original hash, I just hash that, look up the key with that key, and whoever wants to decrypt it, they just have the original hash to decrypt it with.
I still don't get it.
But I'm not decrypting it. The person just shows me the hash, and I can find, I don't know what the data is, but I know that this data can be decrypted by this key. I'm stereo, by the way.
Yeah, you're big.
Cool.
It might be that you were stereo the whole time, because I think this meter here showed two.
Okay, cool.
Anyway.
So I'm kind of getting it.
Yeah.
So it's very.
Is the point that at the point where you're storing stuff on your hard disk?
Yeah.
If you don't know, like what it's what that file originally was part of, or like what file it was part of.
Then you are unable to
decrypt it. And you can show to a third party that you have not the means, that you have no, you don't have the keys to.
Because the whoever sent it to me somehow through the other nodes, when it trickled down to me through the network, then whoever requested with this hash. So that's also kind of how they find it on node.
Yes. So all the routing and the finding and the synchronization works on the original hash. Mm-hmm. However, when you store it on your local hard drive, you store it at the address of the hash.
Mm. And when I store it at that address, it gets distributed to all the nodes with that address. That's how it works.
Yes. So all the distribution is based on the original hash. Yeah? Mm.
Okay, I don't think I get it fully, but...
Maybe I don't get it fully as well.
But I need to look... I think it doesn't make sense to talk longer about it.
Okay.
I need to maybe read up on it or something. Let's just assume it's possible.
Let's assume. That would be good.
To have plausible deniability. And that's a good thing, definitely, because it will make it very unlikely that people store your stuff if they don't have plausible deniability, that they knew what they were storing.
There's another scheme, just to round this off. There's another scheme which you can do interesting stuff. So, for example, if you have an ENS registry.
That was the name system?
Yes, that's the name system. Yeah. So ENS registry, you have a domain which is linked to an identity. And with such identities, you can actually require certain signed statements about hashes. So for example, you can require a file to be encrypted or signed off with that identity or the URL that it's found on, and that's kind of has interesting properties, because if you require certain a particular type of file to be integrity protected in such a strong way, then you basically have it's like actual copyright protection in a way.
Okay, what does this?
So if you release a song, and you put it under a particular URL, and your identity somehow
is known
on the blockchain,
and
that has the domain in the ENS associated.
So it's my name.
Yes,
I created this.
Yes.
Name.
Then any. Recoding or download of that asset from another URL will not be possible if your browser or if your Swarm instance enforces this coding. So that means that it's still not protection in the strong sense, but we can have an agreement that we do file sharing only.
Only
with files that confirm to this.
Yeah, so there would be a consensus in the Swarm network not to allow retrieval of files that are protected in this way.
Particular type of files, obviously, like blockchain data doesn't have to be protected in any way.
Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting. I wonder if that flies at all.
I wonder as well.
But we will see.
So what about the team? I'm sort of totally changing the topic, because I usually look at the project and think, do they have a cool team? I know there's you, and there are other two guys who, and they are pretty powerful, and all of you are long Ethereum long timers, right?
Yes. I mean, the history of Swarm is a bit tarnished with lots of difficulties, both in terms of. There was a time when Ethereum funding was like not so clear, and there were some austerities, and at that time like the scope of the project was seriously constricted, and we only concentrated on the incentive system at that time. And since then the foundation's financials kind of somewhat improved, so the project came on like full force, And actually, we're expanding the team at the moment. Mm. So, but now that you asked about the team members, so Daniel Nagy, who's a cryptographer and kind of professor at university, he's basically the father of Swarm, the specific idea that the way we should do Swarm is a strictly content addressed chunk store with the semi permanent relaying connections. That was the original insight. That is how we should do it. Some of this was kind of serendipitous as well, but we'll see how it pans out in the long term. So he's basically the father of the idea. And we had a very strong team member joining in May, Nick Johnson, who wrote the ENS, the Ethereum name service, and also put the swarms on a really a stable testnet with a Docker cluster, so he had an amazing contribution to Swarm. And we had the first year we had Joët Fefferdi, who's the author of the Light client. He used to work on Swarm, and he wrote pretty much the entire storage layer for Swarm. And now we're expanding, and we also have Aaron Fisher on the team, who I usually present with. He's the fellow in the responsible for R&D.
And you also wrote the white papers with Aaron and Zolt, right? Some of them.
Well, we call it the Orange Paper series.
Ah, the Orange Papers.
Yes,
right.
So that's meant to be a kind of a series of papers about Swarm and like peer-to-peer related research, especially as it relates to blockchain. So the first two papers was the incentive system, the swap swear and swindle scheme, and the second one is more technical. It's about a very particular proof of custody scheme, and hopefully there's going to be others, because there's a lot of research going on. I hope I can say now that we're recruiting, so if anyone's interested, sure.
They should contact you.
Us. Yes.
So we spoke a lot, I think, about Swap, but we didn't talk a lot about Swear, unless I was distracted trying to fill
we did,
the
we
cables.
Did. That was the, registration and litigation part. Yeah.
Okay.
So that was the storage insurance we chatted about.
And what was the swindle part? That's the
swindle is when you actually litigate. So when you
really
challenge someone, oh, you swindled.
Yeah.
Ah, right.
You challenge
yeah.
someone that they foul played.
Okay.
And it's yeah.
So. Should we then start slowly? Do you feel like you had a chance to talk about most parts of Swarm?
Yeah,
and maybe
you can ask about if you want to hear about some future developments.
Yes, I forgot about this Mist integration that you mentioned. Maybe we should talk about that as well, because Mist is kind of hot.
Mist is the browser, the wallet. It was the wallet, right? And now it's separate. It's
sorry, not Mist. What I'm talking about?
Yeah, Mist probably.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I need to drink some water.
I think it's now called Ethereum Wallet, or it's two applications now.
But it's just temporary. So wallet is supposed to be a particular DApp that runs in Mist.
Okay.
But since that was the first kind of. DApp, and that was really the main point that there should be a wallet.
But this should be a generic DApp browser.
I mean, the original vision is that Mist is really a browser with an app store availability of an app store.
An app store of DApps.
App store of DApps or DApp store actually. Sorry, can serve those and serve them from decentralized content distribution system. So it should support IPFS, BZZ, Swarm, and hopefully with time it might support some sort of messaging apps, domain registration, things like sending checks, maybe have an interface to Raiden, maybe have an interface to you know, some sort of, you know, natively supported. But
so how far is the integration of Swarm into Mist?
It's basically done. I mean, it's integration of Swarm is really, really very easy because it has an HTTP proxy. So any library of any renderer or any kind of browser framework can immediately support Swarm through the HTTP proxy. The actual HTTP, the way we serve the HTTP is obviously a little bit underdeveloped. So, for example, it's not really clear yet how we handle the setting of headers, for example, because you know, it's Swarm internal. Like the actual serving of HTTP content is Swarm internal. So we have to, you know, set the headers in kind of a special way.
I don't get it. So the Swarm daemon is set up as if it was an HTTP proxy?
Correct.
So from like, outside, like, yeah, a squid, I would ask it for content. There is a proxy interface to use it.
Yes.
So
the Swarm daemon from the outside, from the user's perspective,
yeah,
is an HTTP local. It runs on localhost port 8500,
yeah,
and it accepts get and put and post requests.
Okay.
So post requests is when you upload stuff. Get requests is when you retrieve stuff, and it's supposed to do all the kind of nice stuff for you. So it does domain name resolution directly from the BZZ URL scheme.
Okay.
And what we haven't talked about yet, and maybe don't want to go into details, but the way actually URL based lookup works, because that's not obvious how you do URL based. Yeah. It's in a chunk store, which stores stuff by hash. So that's where
you have a scheme, a URL scheme.
URL scheme, and there's a file container format called manifest, Swarm manifest, and the manifest is nothing but it's like you can think about it as a sitemap or as a directory tree.
Okay.
It basically maps paths to hashes.
So you could have in Mist, you could have an HTML page. This could also be already been served by this proxy.
Yes.
And it would contain references to assets that could be served by this.
This is actually working.
Yeah. So. And also the JavaScript can be served.
Yes.
But you could also have an API that this thing uses that is not served by this proxy, but that is served by an API provider that provides basically the business logic.
Very much for asking this, because this is a crucial point.
Yeah.
So obviously everybody sees now, as you explained very well, how static content or maybe it's like a simple JavaScript animation type of content can work.
Yeah.
On Swarm, that's pretty easy. But today's web applications are usually interactive and they have a lot of host to like data, underlying databases and all kinds of communication services. Now, if you store your database on the blockchain, if that's kind of public data, like in the case of, you know, a wallet, that's solved for you, because that's what the blockchain is. It's a distributed database. But for other types of things that would probably blow the blockchain, for example, if you have a Facebook-like social media app, you really don't want every like to be on the blockchain. So there should be solutions for this, and this is the next generation problem that we have to face in the coming years. How to solve rapid database communications in a decentralized way?
Could be the messaging system.
But it's also Samuli, who's now doing OrbitDB.
Yes.
He was working on trying to, because I had this obsession. I wanted to host a wiki on IPFS, and a wiki obviously every edit ended up with like a new hash, and it's just like a mess. So I was talking to him a lot about this, and that's what you're telling about as well, right?
Yes, ish. So I'm more talking about like the best case. What I was talking about is like, you know, data, a lot of like sophisticated querying a database, which cannot be on the blockchain because it's too big or too, I don't know, maybe private in some bits. And so basically database queries, like what current web applications use in their backend, or messaging systems. What you are saying is with the frequent updates, maybe that also has a database backend, and that's also the problem. But with the frequent updates, there's also a problem, because just as we said, the ENS is the domain name registry is the only point where data can be mutable, because otherwise with the hashes and the integrity protected nature of content address, mm-hmm. which means that if you change one byte in your CV, that's a different hash.
Yes.
So if you want your CV up on Xenia.eth, then you're in trouble, because every time maybe your CV is not a good idea, maybe your Twitter feed, whatever. If your Twitter feed has to sit on Xenia.eth/Twitter, then you're in trouble, because you have to update it every, say you tweet every 5 minutes, mm-hmm. then you have to update it every 5 minutes and pay. And maybe that's too much. Or maybe you're a, or maybe even worse applications like flight information update. If you want to have integrity on those kind of things, it's the ENS or the blockchain is too, even too slow and too too cumbersome and too costly for that. So the interesting bit is to come up with a scheme which allows some sort of mutable content.
Maybe append. Maybe append content. Maybe that's easier to track than change stuff.
Yes. Yeah, so that's basically, basically Git. Mm-hmm. And there's a project called Mango, which implements Git on Swarm and IPFS. That's already...
Mango, like M-A-N-G-O.
Like the fruit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like the fruit.
Okay.
And there's also another scheme that... that we're thinking of, which is, it's not fully worked out, but just the basic idea is that somehow you provide a stream of, basically a chain of versions that you sign, mm-hmm. and the signature can be checked against the domain that you sign on the ENS, but still have kind of real-time updates with integrity, but without having to consult the blockchain. So that's basically roughly the idea.
Okay. So that would be ahead. Stuff to come. I don't know where we are in this list here, actually.
I keep just shuffling things around, actually.
That's nice. What's next?
And I'm trying to add links as we go, because we received some feedback from the listeners saying, you talk about interesting stuff, but the links are not in order. So I'm trying to add the link, or at least
at the
keyword.
Right place.
Yeah.
Okay, Mango, for example. I can't see you writing anywhere here.
Yeah, but now I'm just, it says links and I'm writing there.
Okay.
In general, the interesting thing is like how these different technology, peer-to-peer and distributed technologies will finally come together. So I really believe that that when this peer-to-peer research, which is very mature, the whole file sharing kind of research existed like 20 years ago, and it was in some form. And this, the research is quite advanced in these fields. But I believe that blockchain was really the last missing piece of the puzzle, because it provides a very smooth way for these peer systems to be completely trustless and interact according to an incentive system, which only presupposes like self-interested rational actors. But the emergent property of the system is somehow beneficial to the whole system that you opt in to participate. And these systems are very, very powerful. This can range from the usual textbook blockchain example of land registry and governance, all the way to kind of swarm and content distribution networks.
I mean, there are currently already quite successful content distribution networks, like BitTorrent, for example. But the incentive is actually only the content itself, right? I mean...
Well, I mean, fame. Some sort of Vanity Fair is going on there, but... Yeah. But that motivates only the few geeks.
Yeah. And also, there are these people called leechers. I think we had them also 20 years ago already. Mm-hmm. That were only downloading but never uploading. So yes, there was this upload-download ratio. So, yeah, it's interesting to have a system that might in itself have an incentive to participate that only... So in my understanding, I mean, maybe that changes also. I have an internet connection at home, and I have a computer that is running anyway that has storage, and I would be totally fine to share space on that thing, and also share like a part of my internet, especially the downstream. But that's not the interesting part, probably, because I never use up my downstream, but I easily use up my upstream. Mm-hmm. But if this becomes popular, I would guess that the company providing me with that internet connection, they will probably send me a different bill because if I'm really using their stuff in which
they were not prepared
planning. Yeah, yeah. They
unfortunately I have nothing to say to this. Like,
it will be interesting
the future, like how you know the different use patterns can influence the business logic that currently internet providers have.
Yeah, it will be interesting.
I have no clue.
Maybe I have an example. So I have a shell host somewhere, and it's supposed to have 100 megabit per second. And after a terabyte, it's supposed to have only 10 megabit per second. Mm-hmm. So that's the deal. It throttles me. And now I recently got an email. So I'm operating a Tor relay there. So I can easily go above a terabyte. So before running this Tor relay, I looked at the conditions, and 10 megabit is fine for me. So I started this, and like a year ago actually, and recently they sent me an email saying there was suspicious traffic on your host, and we disabled it.
And
you can restart it and have a look. So I restarted it because I already knew what was happening, and sent them an email saying, please, actually I didn't say please. I said, in your conditions, you say that you will throttle me after a terabyte, so I expect that this will run, and I know the traffic is fine, and let's see if they throttle or disable my host again.
Well, they
again.
Usually claim that you're spamming people.
Yeah, well, it's only a relay node. It's not an exit node. If it was an exit node, then that would be an issue. So what's your problem with internet service providers running your hosts?
Well, yeah, I run exit nodes as well.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
I always had problems with...
Yeah, yeah, I was running providers. An exit node like 10 years ago. Actually, 10 years ago. And then I got a visit from the police, so that was not fun. Since then, I only run relays. Anyway, it's a different story.
So interesting. I'm kind of like floating out of the conversation sometimes.
Sorry, just, we were digressing anyway.
Yeah, no, I'm just like trying to read stuff at the same time. It's like after this podcast, I don't think that anyone would ever answer what's the difference between IPFS and Swarm, because you explain the incentive mechanism, but how do they relate to each other?
Well, thanks for asking. So, yeah, better to clarify. So, I have a huge respect for the whole IPFS project, and I really consider that as a major inspiration, even a kind of umbrella, really, for what we do. So, I think that there's gonna be a point when we're gonna standardize the protocols and kind of rewrite some of the swarms so that it actually properly operates with the IPFS standard interfaces. I feel that this moment is not. Yeah, I went through various stages of like what I thought about IPFS. The first period, I was accused by Juan of not understanding IPFS, and he was bloody right. I didn't. And once I understood, I was like really, really adamant to kind of, you know, collaborate and basically put together our resources and like do something together. Now I feel that we're going slightly different directions, and I think the space is kind of new and exciting enough to warrant two slightly different directions, because these are unexplored areas. So it will actually strengthen the ecosystem to have slightly different working systems. But as I say, I consider IPFS the de facto umbrella of all peer-to-peer communication, all kind of peer-to-peer protocols. So I would like to kind of come back and integrate into IPFS. But the Swarm specific innovations that I would like to think are useful, they kind of warrant that we keep on doing this research and see whether it works, whether it has some merits.
So you are saying what you are implementing with Swarm is like on the edge of what is. So there's still stuff research that you would like to implement. So it's not there yet.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I don't want to be complacent with the innovativeness of Swarm.
It also means that you can fail, right?
Yes, absolutely.
If you have to do the research while running your stuff, I mean, with the stuff running, it's like we call banana software. It's delivered green, and then it gets ripe with the customer. So it's also a risk.
Yes, it is a risk. It is a risk. It is a risk with IPFS too, which is also kind of not even beta software yet. And but yeah. So Swarm. I would really like to emphasize this idea that you can post on Swarm and you can do upload and disappear behavior. At least when the incentives are properly installed. And that plus certain ideas about how these manifests are organized, which I just talked about briefly, like how we map URLs to hashes, the way that can be used as database key value indexes. That's also somewhat different from the IPFS idea, and it's worth exploring these like slightly different schemes.
So the Swarm is compatible, as far as I remember, it might be not true anymore, the IPFS network protocol is kind of similar to Ethereum,
yes.
Because there was a lot of cross-pollination,
exactly,
and all the guys
exactly,
know each
exactly,
other,
exactly.
And then Swarm theoretically is also kind of, does it mean that it will be compatibility and interoperability might be not as bad as it usually is with like different projects. Does it even matter the network protocol for this, like node discovery and so on?
Not really. I mean, Swarm could easily run like with very little work. We could run Swarm on Leap peer to peer, which is the name for the let's name the baby. It's the IPFS.
How's it called? LIB?
Leap peer to peer.
LEP, right?
Lib, as in lib, library.
Lib.
Lib, peer-to-peer.
L-I-B?
Yeah, lib,
P2P.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the IPFS one.
Yes, and the Ethereum one is Dev peer-to-peer, which was inspired by the peer-to-peer originally, but they both kind of diverged in weird ways. We can talk hours about it, whether it was worth it, whether it was like duplicated effort, whether it's even sound at the moment. Like, there's a lot of debates about this. The point is that Swarm is like... So the code of Swarm like currently relies on this dev peer to peer, but it's really just a simple interface. The actual communication protocol that defines Swarm, or like the behavior, the syncing, the retrieval, is orthogonal to that layer, so Leap peer-to-peer could actually run it. There was even a talk with the IPFS guys whether we should maybe join the IPFS DHT, but currently I'm not entirely sure it's that relevant, because as long as the actual the swarm storage protocol is completely different behavior, then it's not going to be really crosstalk between like IPFS nodes and swarm nodes.
Mm.
Unless we like, you know, on top of swarm protocol, we support the IPFS protocol as well. But that's kind of it's easier if we just integrate it on the level of mists, for example, that you can just, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so in principle, it's like agnostic to the actual protocol layer. But at the moment, we use that peer to peer, and it has certain properties that are suitable for us.
Yeah, so I'm skipping sort of a general talk about decentralization, because I think most people who listen to Dirk other podcasts, they sort of understand this thing. So
I don't get it.
Decentralization.
No, but I mean, we don't have to go through like
why a decentralization.
Yes, because I think that's pretty clear to our listeners at least.
Hmm.
So what else did we sufficiently cover swarm? I'm kind of a little bit brain fried already.
I wouldn't be surprised. I honestly never had the chance to talk in such amazing detail about swarm. I'm really grateful to you guys for these questions. I'm really cool. Really feel I had a really good opportunity to explain.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for explaining it, because I never had a chance to talk to anyone about swarm details. Last time, Daniel and yourself, you presented, and then we just went with Daniel and spoke about totally different stuff, because both of you, then I can just like start wrapping up slowly, and both of you come from sort of cypherpunk
movement
and demographic, whatever you would call it. So maybe you can tell a little bit about yourself, because I presented you as like, this guy knows about Ethereum, but what about like you personally?
Well, what do you want to know? It's like,
no, like what? How come you started like working on Ethereum, for instance?
Okay, so I've been into Bitcoin for quite a while, so I'm one of the people who definitely come from the Bitcoin space into Ethereum. So my interest in crypto and, you know, money currency and like this type of stuff, the technical side is come from my interest in Bitcoin, and that's also how I heard about the white paper and Vitalik, because there was a conference in Miami that I was following already. Now, how did I come to Bitcoin? That's an interesting question, because, you know, obviously an interesting tag, but there's a lot of people in tech who just, you know, not interested in particularly in Bitcoin. So I'm coming from the angle of being interested in crypto from in a kind of ideological or social perspective as well. I really believe in freedom as the solution to most problems of the world, and the importance of decentralization and tools that allow trustless interaction is a crucial vehicle in making sure that you have free interaction between individuals and secure interaction. And I really believe that these technologies are a major accomplishment, civilizational accomplishment, and I think they can be very powerful in bringing about social change on a scale that can be compared to the internet itself even.
When you say trustless, do you mean it in the way that Bitcoin is trustless, or is there a different meaning? You said you come from it even before Bitcoin, so there must be some other meaning before Bitcoin about trustlessness.
Trustlessness here is used like really in the generic sense that I believe that's what it's used in crypto as well. It basically means that I can interact with you and believe your reputation, your money that you give me. I have ways to accept your payment. I have a way to verify your reputation without having any particular individual or organization that we both have to trust.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so trustless means to have a way to trust each other without trusting a third party.
Yeah, basically without trusting each other as well. But
yeah, but trusting in math.
Yes, trusting a third party, which always creates some sort of either leakage in the system or creates an obstacle for innovation, because it's always added to the most minimal setting, which is direct transaction between
trustless
parties.
Yeah, trustless in communication is like more like Byzantine problem. It's like trustless communication channel. So communication channel can't fiddle with your information, like whatever you use to communicate.
Like integrity.
Yeah, that's security and integrity of communication. It's one thing.
Yeah.
Here, of course, with the blockchain and trustlessness, it's really the consensus. Like what protects you from the other person or anyone like faking that information about their reputation, and the only thing that can protect you is community consensus or like global consensus. And how to do global consensus in a decentralized way, that was totally not the solved problem before Satoshi solved it, whoever that is.
Yeah, so Bitcoin solves the problem that I can trust a payment to me to be permanent after 6 confirmations.
Yes, basically.
And with Ethereum, it's much more, right? It's also about trusting the computation has been done.
Correct.
And
actually, Alex Leverington, who worked on peer-to-peer protocol on network Ethereum network, he put it very nicely, and I always quote him. He said, "So Bitcoin is about integrity of data, and Ethereum is about integrity of code, and that's pretty much."
Yes.
Explains it.
Yes.
Maybe a bit simplified, but
you can say that. And the computation is, there's a lot of debates these days because of the failings and bugs in Ethereum, especially. There was a lot of heated debate about whether it's really a good thing to have such a powerful secured computation, like because the whole idea of Ethereum is that it's not only any computation that's secured, but any computation of any complexity, really, and that's not immediately obvious whether it's a good idea because any complexity it can be really complex, and those complexities can bring out bugs and consensus failures much easier because it's a lot of complexity that we can overlook, and that's a very crucial question that. Only time will tell whether this is really feasible or not. I truly believe that Ethereum so far kind of fulfilled that promise. But we see how what the future brings. I think the generality of computation with Ethereum is really an attractive proposal because it really allows dApps it's not the platform that inherently has any restrictions. You don't have to tiptoe around any restriction. You really have to only tiptoe around being very secure, which is kind of, you can say that it's the same problem, but it's after all not.
Cool. So then to wrap up, you told us that you don't mind asking personal questions.
Go ahead.
And it's kind of an odd question because usually you don't ask people about this stuff.
Yeah.
You have Parkinson's and you're still doing a lot of cool shit. So because, our listeners don't know. So I was just wondering if you can comment on like being involved in like sexy startups like Ethereum, being a digital nomad and crypto anarchist and doing all this cool stuff. And because it's sort of an annoying condition, right? And Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I imagine it must be pretty annoying because I don't know. Maybe the listeners obviously don't know that at the moment I'm kind of throwing myself left and right. This is actually not a symptom of Parkinson's, but it's actually a side effect of too much medication in my bloodstream. But it must be bloody annoying for my conversation partners, you know, to see someone like constantly throwing them back and forth. And often when I give talks, for example, it can be pretty annoying for the audience. Like I often find my voice quivering and, you know, not very easy to deliver lines and or even stand on my feet when the medications don't work properly. So yes, it has annoying
aspects. No, but I mean, I don't find it annoying for your audience, no. Because I like hanging out with you, so I don't find it annoying. I just thought it's kind of, I mean, I never really see you miserable. So somehow you manage.
Well, you know, if you have a chronic annoyance, then you have to learn to live with it. Otherwise, your life will be miserable. So such conditions actually have often have quite a positive effect on your self-development, because it often shows you some sort of light, shows you some aspects of your life which you should be grateful for. And you know, if your days are so that you can even, you know, be very happy and rejoice over the ability to even stand on your feet, or like sometimes being able to walk a few steps when I'm low on medication, it can be a really great experience. Then, you know, it's, you know, sometimes puts in a little bit of a lamp in your head, like, which you can always switch on when you're kind of down or under the weather. It taught me a lot, let's put it that way.
Cool, thanks for answering this. Okay, so should we just all go and have some more mate and some cigarettes and
let's
say goodbye to everyone?
Wrap it up. And thank you, Victor, for being here. And actually, now I have an idea about Swarm. That's and awesome. how it works and how it's supposed to work, which awesome. I didn't. I mean, I awesome. Knew something about it, but...
I'm happy to hear you out. and thank you. I'm really grateful for the great questions, guys, and really, really grateful for the opportunity to go into such detail, which I cool. know and already yeah. can't. Thank you.
Cool. Bye.
Okay, that's it, right?
Bye, listeners.
Okay, goodbye. I will pull this down here, this one. Bye.